Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We welcome you to participate in this interlodge symposium today on theosophical themes in Western mysticism. The participants and speakers from the platform today are associates, volunteer associates of the United Lodge of Theosophists from Washington, D.C., New York, and Philadelphia. Our format today will be several different talks on different aspects of Western mysticism, followed by a period for questions, answers, discussion, and so we'll proceed through the program. The first hour or so, we will be discussing the mystic ways of the West, common characteristics of Jewish, Christian, and Sufi mysticism, and then a talk on Jewish mysticism of the Kabbalah. We'll take our 10-minute break, then the historical roots of Christian mysticism, which will consist of three separate talks, followed by a short break, and then the final segment will be on the mysticism of the Sufis and challenges and opportunities of Western mysticism in our times. So we want to begin then with this idea that this will not be a program on instructing practical techniques in mysticism. Each one of the traditions presented today has their own emphasis and practice. Our purpose really today is to see the underlying thread that unites them all, what we might call the theosophical themes in Western mysticism. And very often we think of mysticism as associated with Eastern religions and philosophies, but for a few thousand years now, there has been a very vibrant thread of mysticism, even into our modern times, perhaps more open and productive than it's been for centuries in our modern times. So we're going to begin with the mysticism, the mystic ways of the West, and try to identify some of those underlying universal themes that we'll see throughout the afternoon. So let's just begin then with the understanding of what we mean by the word mysticism, because it's different from metaphysics or philosophy. It's different from a religious experience and religion, although elements of mysticism, of course, are found in all those traditions. So mysticism offers a view of what lies beyond the phenomenal knowledge we all have available through our physical senses. So what we usually call a reality is the objective experience we experience through our senses. But there is a reality beyond which the mystics down through the ages have talked about and in some ways demonstrated. So mysticism provides the individual with access to a realm of knowledge and experience that is not completely expressible in the written word or speech. So they can speak of it in allegorical ways, in symbolic ways, but like the experience of love, any word does not completely express the intensity and reality of the inner hidden feeling and knowledge associated with mysticism. And so many of the terms used are symbolic and provide keys to the individual through which they can get a better understanding. So throughout our exploration of Western mysticism, we'll see a path which has various elements. elements of intense individual devotion, commitment, consistency of practice, and also times of silent contemplation, meditation, and inner recollection of the divine as an essential activity. So the point is that mysticism is a way of life which involves the entire human being and engages every aspect of their relationships and interactions with others. So mysticism is not a religion per se, although it is an aspect, as we will see, of Western religions, just as it is an aspect of Eastern religion. So when we use the term religion or a religion today, we're defining it as a way of life which may be based on mystical experiences, but it involves shared physical practices and rituals as well as exoteric symbols to express the inner mystical experience. So religions may have various rituals and practices and texts and sacred symbols, but these are outward or exoteric ways of expressing the real religious or mystic experience that the individual knows. It is a way of communicating and practicing them as a community. Mysticism, then, is an awareness of an inner dimension of being that is otherwise hidden, or we might say esoteric, and not available to the physical senses. So one cannot tell by the way one dresses or talks or behaves whether they are mystically inclined or not. It is totally a subjective reality, although, as we will see, it has effects on our outward expression. We said what a religion is, but religion itself, if we understand it from its Latin derivation, means to bind all things and beings back to one ultimate divine reality, while mysticism instructs the individual on how to gain access to that reality, since there is something in the human being that is one with that reality. So there's the key idea of mysticism. It speaks of an ultimate divine reality, a essence or aspect of that reality in the individual, so there must be a bridge or a path which can unite the two, the individual with the universal. And mysticism is that way of uniting. So in Jewish, Christian, Sufi mysticism, we see various aspects. But one of the common features of all these three traditions in Western mysticism is that they are closely associated with a image or a monotheistic concept of deity. And the exoteric scriptures of those religions. So traditional Jewish mysticism is associated with the Kabbalah, Sufi mysticism with the Quran, and of course Christian mysticism with the New Testament. They have their roots in that, although there is a whole literature that develops around that. They all contain elements of ecstatic visions, acts of piety, the importance of love for all beings, and more importantly, in terms of today's message, an expression of the knowledge of the relationship between the ultimate divine reality and the human being. They are all scientific in such a way. So some of these are more directed, we might say, to the outer expression of piety and love, Others are more expressed in works of ecstatic visions, singing, poetry, and so forth. The message of Western mysticism, as we find it in these various traditions, is that there is a spiritual world beyond the physical that transcends the senses and is more important to the individual than the transient material world. Now, there is acknowledgement that we need this world. This is where we learn. This is where we interact. But it is phenomenal. It is temporary. What is real and endures and ultimately important to the individual is this spiritual world that mysticism in its various ways tries to connect us with. So the empirical world we understand through our senses is not enough. It's not sufficient to account for our existence. The causes of our being, as what we really are as individuals, the meaning, the reality, the importance of our life, is not to be found there, but is in this spiritual realm primarily. The effect of that reality of our nature is the cause of the material world. So we might say everything that we do outwardly has its seed in a thought and a feeling, in a memory, in an inspiration. We don't see those things with our physical lives, eyes, but they are the ultimate important things of the human experience, and through the power of those faculties, we bring forth into physical manifestation the conditions of this world. So mysticism is a way of putting us more in contact with this life. So according to the message of Western mysticism, the ultimate human purpose in life is for the individual to connect with that reality consciously. And the only way they can do that is by transformation, by becoming that which they want to seek. So we recognize that we have personalities, that we have limitations of the way we think and feel, but through the various mystical understandings and practices, to begin to transform that personal nature, that individual nature, so that it becomes more like the divine. And the different traditions have different ways of expressing that idea of the human being as being a manifestation or a vessel for the divine presence. The ultimate human aim, therefore, involves in moving the heart and mind to a self-conscious realization and knowledge of what is really enduring, valuable, real, and permanent in our lives. So stripped of all the exoteric symbolisms and language and rituals of their distinctive exoteric religious counterparts, Judaism, Christianity, and Sufi in their mystical ways share common, quote, theosophical threads. And we are using that word today, theosophical, in its broadest understanding, that of divine wisdom or knowledge of that spiritual dimension of our lives and of the world around us. So these two ideas, the mystic ways of the West and the common threads in all those traditions, is the first presentation this morning. And before we go into any further discussion of the specifics, we're just wondering, based on what was said, if any of you have any questions or comments, observations in your own research or experience along these lines. So we welcome your contributions along that line. Yes.
was just wondering if the spiritual life is so important, why does it have to be so invisible and hard to know?
If the spiritual life is so important, so real, why is it invisible to our physical senses? What is it about the experiences of our physical senses that make them ultimately, for say, not as important as those inner ones? Any thoughts or ideas on that question? Yes?
Just the most basic one. With our physical senses, we appear to be separate. With our mystical ideation, we know we are one.
So there the idea is the physical senses give us the impression that we are separate from each other. We have different personalities and different bodies, different conditions. We are separate from the world, from our environment, and we are separate from the divine. That's the knowledge or the impression that comes to us through the physical senses. But through the mind and the heart, we can realize that we are more interconnected and alike and similar than that which we would understand through our physical senses, that we are more interconnected in a web of life with nature, and we can understand and feel our interconnection between that which is ultimately enduring and permanent. So we cannot get those things through the physical senses, which only give us glimpses of a passing show of experiences and don't allow us to perceive or feel that which is enduring and permanent. Yes?
The word feel is a key. Because we sometimes we have a feeling that we must be more than this physical form. Mm-hmm. So feeling has many different definitions.
Yes. And if we were to look into the lives of the mystics, what they've written, but even talk with individuals who are mystical by nature, but not necessarily famous or through their writings or through their works in that regard, they acknowledge that at some point they had the feeling that they're and the conviction, even though they couldn't express it in so many words, that there was something more. There had to be something more to themselves and to life than what they could know through the physical experience. There had to be something more significant than just merely trying to exist and survive on this physical plane. And until they had that glimpse, they felt this need to search for that fountain of truth. There was a hand that went up over here.
Yeah. With the physical senses, we only get information about our physical world. But if we develop our inner senses, then that's what enables us to perceive on the inner lines of our being. And until an individual questions as to why am I here, what's the purpose of life, what's the result, what's the highest can be achieved, I don't think you can get in touch with those inner qualities or inner principles of nature, because those also correspond to the cosmic principles, which then gives proof that we're not separate, that we're all united, and not only humanity is united, but that we are united to all the other kingdoms, whether it is the Deva kingdom or the physical ones, elementals and lower kingdoms, animals, plants, and so forth.
So the contribution here in a nutshell is that the physical senses can only connect us with physical experience. We have to develop inner senses, and that may be something that we need to think about what we mean by that, but we all sense or know when we are in the presence of something which is beautiful or awesome or all-expiring. We intuitively know when we are in the presence of greatness or when we are in the presence of danger. We are warned by our intuition. We are warned by our conscience. We are warned by our discernment. All these, we might say, are higher or inner faculties or senses, ways of perceiving our world and our condition that do not rely on the physical senses, and yet they can be developed by individuals and become very important guides in our life. Yes, there was. We'll take one more question.
My question is, why teachings, the Kabbalah, why are all these teachings are so cryptic? Kabbalah is enormously cryptic. Even the English Bible, many statements, people don't know what they mean unless properly interpreted. And I'm looking at what ISIS has done with the Muslim Quran. Obviously, there are bazillion interpretations of how that writing could be interpreted. Why bother giving humanity these teachings if it's a foregone conclusion that they can't possibly be interpreted correctly? And why making these writings so cryptic so that we could not possibly understand the true meaning behind them in the first place?
Well, as we will see, not all the mystical writings are cryptic. Certainly some of them are, especially in the Kabbalah, which we'll get to in a moment. But even there, in the mystical traditions of Judaism, many of them are very forthright and scholarly and practical and poetic. And certainly in the Sufi tradition, we have volumes of writings which are scientific and acutely philosophical and logical, as well as mystically poetical. And certainly in the Christian tradition, we have beautiful prayers and hymns and songs. And if you just think of the words of St. Francis of Assisi, one of the prominent mystics in Christianity, you know you're in the reading something or hearing something that you don't need someone to interpret for you. You don't need a code book to understand. It speaks directly to the heart. So many of these mystics, especially the ones who were gifted with the faculty of being able to speak and write about these realities, use means of expressions that are symbolic, either poetical, but some are very intellectual in their expressions as well. So we're going to pause here and go into the Jewish mysticism of the Kabbalah. Now, we might add at the beginning that the Jewish mysticism is a vast field for thousands of years and comes right up into our modern times. Kabbalah is a portion of it, perhaps the most popular or most recognized form of it, but it does not represent the entire area. And so we're going to present a key or a gateway for those who are interested in maybe furthering their explorations. And we're going to start with referring to certain books that are predominantly connected or understood to be connected with Kabbalah, as well as quoting from certain famous Jewish mystics or Kabbalah themselves in their own words to demonstrate some of these ideas. So we're going to begin with a book called the Sefer Yetzirah, or the book, the word Sefer meaning book, the book of creation. And the most important idea we get from this book of creation is that the mystic or the Kabbalistic concept of the ultimate divine principle is not a being, is not an anthropomorphic image that we might hear expressed in various ways in the exoteric works, but rather the Hebrew word for this ultimate reality is Ein Sof, or no thing. It is the unlimited, absolutely undifferentiated unity. and perhaps the best image we have in our mind to represent this Ein Sof or no thing, which is the ultimate unity, is space. Because space in our minds is unlimited, undifferentiated, a unity which is not interfered with or lessened by anything that exists within it, and yet it is everywhere. It transcends all things, and it is involved, it is imminent in all things. And yet it is no thing. So the rabbis conclude, if it is unlimited, then nothing exists outside of its essence. It is all-embracing. It includes, it's involved with everything visible as well as invisible. It informs, it impresses the inner life of the human being as well as the outer world. So in its most transcendent aspect, it is unknowable. Just like space, we cannot possibly embrace or know with our finite minds the infinitude of space. And yet in its imminent ways, it is knowable through its emanations. And these emanations in the Kabbalistic tradition are called sephiroth. They are emanations or manifestations of the divine in this world and in the human being. We might say that they are principles. They are bases for thought and action, for the operation of forces in the different departments of nature. But they all come from this one source, just as all rays of the sun come from the sun itself, all branches come from the trunk of a tree. And the universal tree of life is a very popular and well-known Kabbalistic image of these emanations or these roots and branches coming forth from the central trunk of the unmanifested deity. And so we'll quote from Rabbi Azarel, who says, "Know that which is perceivable and understandable to human contemplation is limited, and that everything that is limited is finite, and that everything that is finite is insignificant. Conversely, that which is not limited is called Ein Sof, and is absolutely undifferentiated in a complete and changeless unity. And if he is without limit, then nothing exists outside him. And since he both exalted and hidden, he is the essence of all that is concealed and revealed." And hundreds of years later, a rabbi, Cordovero, wrote on this transcendence and immanence of God as Ein Sof and the Sephiroth: "God is in all reality, but not all of reality is in God." Meaning that God, as the absolute, permeates all things, embraces all things, but that there are these emanations or these expressions during a period of manifestation in which this essence of God operates and creates the world, which are part of our reality, but we cannot speak of them as gods or as God. So in this tradition, we see the struggle to try to define what is ultimate, enduring, the permanent, and that which is an expression. This becomes very important later on, as we will see. So this is this Sefer Yetzirah, the book of creation, showing us how everything in the universe has been created, has come forth from this ultimate reality, this ultimate unity, through the operation of its emanations or its manifestations or its principles. This central book, the central canon or text of the Kabbalistic mysticism, is the Zohar, which is translated to mean the Book of Splendor. And in this book, we hear that there are 10 sephiroth, or emanations of the divine, and they are present not only in the world, but in human beings as well. That this divine essence not only creates and establishes the universe, but is present in the human being. Now, there is a balance, an interaction in this divine order of the universe, and whenever there is an interference or a disruption or a disharmony in that interaction within the universe, this is what brings forth evil or suffering. In other words, evil or separation is not the result or the action of some outside being, but it is the result of the disturbance or harmony or imbalance in nature. And human beings should maintain balance in their lives because they are connected with this cosmos, and by establishing harmony and balance in their own lives, they can affect, reestablish, or contribute to the harmony and balance of the world at large. So we begin to see the establishment in this tradition that the mystic has a very definite connection, as we all do, but the mystic tries to consciously live in the service of providing that harmony. So the Zohar was first compiled by a famous rabbinical sage, Simeon ben Yohai, who lived in the 2nd century AD. In the 13th century, it was reproduced by Rabbi Moses de Leon, who claimed to have found these teachings in older works. When it was finally completed by him in the year 1286 AD, it included 26 distinct compositions. It was an anthology of commentaries on the Torah, stories, and treatises on mysticism. And throughout his work, because when we speak of the Kabbalah and study the Kabbalah today, it is basically, for us, the English translation of the original Aramaic of his work in the 13th century. And we see there that the Zohar is not a practical manual on how to become a mystic or practice mysticism. Rather, it represents a knowledge of understanding of what God is, how creation came forth, and this world through a reading of the Torah. And here we get to the idea presented of the mysterious uses of words and symbols and so forth. So in the Kabbalistic tradition, every word and letter of the Torah has a hidden meaning that can be deciphered through the numerical value. So in other words, the Torah can be read in its exoteric and its semantic understanding, but if we understand the hidden meaning or the hidden numerical values of the letters through the system of gematria, then we get a different message or an inner understanding. And for an example of that, the 10 sephiroth, or emanations, by which the heaven and earth were established correspond to the 10 commandments. These sephiroth are found within human beings also. So the important message here is that the human being is a small copy of the universe, a microcosm of the macrocosm, as above, so below. Therefore, if we are a copy, if we are a microcosm, if we are an aspect of the universal, human beings can affect the cosmos, just as the cosmos affects human beings. So as we said, this divine harmony of the sephiroth can be imbalanced. It is the disturbance of the divine order of the sephiroth which produces evil. The human mission, then, especially that of the mystic, is to maintain balance and harmony within their own nature, an imbalance in the human being causes a separation of that which should be united. Now, if we were going to translate into this into the words of Eastern mysticism, we would be talking about karma, a word that expresses that universal harmony within nature, and how whenever that harmony and balance is disturbed, we have suffering in the world. But that human beings can either disturb it through their own thought and action, or they can help restore it. The point is that that same idea, even though not said as karma, is expressed in a different way in the Kabbalah, and we will get to that those words in a moment. So the Hebrew expression, or the Kabbalistic expression, Tikkun HaOlam, Olam meaning the world, translates into mending the world by understanding, devotion, following the Ten Commandments, the world is mended. So mysticism, according to the Kabbalah, is not an individual indulgence. It's not the individual pursuit of purely becoming one with God and being enamored with that divine presence and just existing for one's own benefit. Rather, it is a mission to help restore the harmony and balance not only within themselves, but within nature. In other words, to become a co-worker with nature, a servant of nature. One of the most famous Kabbalistic mystics, his name was Rabbi Isaac Luria, and his students affectionately called him Ari. He lived from 1534 to 1572, and he was to exert the most influence on the future of Jewish mysticism. All the mysticism we have in the Kabbalah, most of it that we have today in its various expressions, the way it's practiced around the world, is influenced to some degree, more or less, by this individual. The teaching of the transmigration of souls, metempsychosis, or what is known in the East as reincarnation, and Gilgul in Judaism, had already been an integral part of the Kabbalah. However, the significance of souls existing in one body after another was emphasized by Ari. Prior to Ari, as we have said, the Torah, the written word, was regarded as the inspired word of God, and something of God was in every word and letter of the text. In other words, the Torah was the most sacred manifestation of the presence of God in the world. Ari emphasized that the presence of God, or the divine, was more rooted in the human being than in the Torah. Therefore, it was the mission of the mystic to manifest in the world through their own nature the presence of the divine. So we see the moving in modern Kabbalah away from the idea of the Torah or the written word being the most important, but rather the development, the transformation of the human being to become the most complete manifestation as possible in the world of the divine presence. Ari emphasized the practice of mysticism as a way to achieve conscious union with God and to affect nature. His theosophical principles can be expressed in these three Hebrew words, and we might say these are the words that would be synonymous with the whole idea of karma. Tsinsun, concentration and withdrawal, the ebb and flow of the Sephiroth. And what he meant by this is we have this divine unity, and we spoke of the principles of the Sephiroth as emanating forces coming forth and establishing this world, establishing this cosmos. But then after a cycle of time, they return to God. And the importance of metempsychosis is that each individual soul, human soul, is a spark of the divine, exiled from the divine, scattered, differentiated, but in the course of time will return to and become one with that divine essence. So we see here that whole process of spiritual evolution, a moving away, a separation, a differentiation, and then a return to the divine through the whole process of evolution. The second Hebrew word that he taught or expression was the breaking of the vessels, a cosmic disruption or differentiation and separation from the divine unity affects all cosmos and humans. Evil comes into the world through separation, disruption, and imbalance. Human beings and the world become broken vessels of the divine. By this he means as these souls come forth from the divine and incarnate into bodies, they forget who and what they are. They become identified with the physical expression. And in that sense, their vessels, their forms, their personalities become broken. They are no longer the true expressions of the divine. So they need to become, to restore themselves as the bright vessels. And tikkun is the Hebrew word that means mending or uniting, is the cosmic role of human beings. By adhering to the commandments with the right motive, the mystic helps mend the world. Human beings play a critical and pivotal role in the cosmic drama. The divine element in the human being is absolutely necessary in order for the drama to reach a satisfying restoration of balance. In the words of Ari. So there is this divine spark or essence within each human being, and by recognizing it and help trying to manifest it, that becomes the key part for the mystic in not only balancing their own nature, but helping to restore the balance of nature. So in this tradition of Hebrew or Jewish mysticism, we have expressed this understanding that we are in our divine essence, one with God, and through that knowledge can become creators or restorers of the harmony and balance and make a difference in this world. Through that power of that realization, that inner experience, transform ourselves and transform the world in which we live. So we'll stop here and invite your questions and comments on this tradition. Yes.
You said God, I think you said God did not create everything. And then you talked about the disharmony around us sometimes. Is that where the devil comes in the Christian terminology? And we create the devil, if you will?
Well, the question relates to how would the Kabbalah view this whole concept of the devil? And in the Kabbalah, just as the divine reality is not conceived as a being, but rather as a reality which is universal, undifferentiated, permanent, absolute, in other words, has no defining conditions, so to the devil is not a being, an opponent of that. Rather, the source of good and evil in the world, in the human being, is of one essence. Everything comes from one source, this ultimate absolute. But when coming into manifestation, there is differentiation. There is duality. These sephiroth, as they emanate in pairs. And so we see distinctions made between justice and harmony, knowledge and understanding. as a, in ways of expressing the duality of these emanations. And so they can become imbalanced. We can see in sometimes in our life the feeling part of our nature, the compassionate part of our nature, is overwhelmed by the intellectual. And when that happens, we may become too cold or unfeeling or unresponsive. And at other times, the compassionate feeling part of our nature becomes too predominant over the reasoning and the intellectual, so that we become too sensitive, not discriminating enough in what we do, and may perform and do things which produce more harm, maybe out of good intention, but produce more harm than good. And so it is the imbalance in the principles, in the way we act, that produces evil. Likewise, it is the balance, the wisdom, the harmony of how to use our principles, in other words, knowledge of ourselves, that produces good or helps restore it. So that would be the Kabbalistic understanding of that idea. And once again, we can see that that is what karma is in the East. It's an exact expression, but in a different symbolic language. Yes?
Myself just a wee bit troubled because I've been made aware from two friends who are graduate school trained, world travelers, multi-language, high IQ people who tell me they don't believe in God. So I do, and have had evidence, incredible evidence in my own life. So my question is, in your tradition, what would you advise is the appropriate, should I just stand down and just not discuss this, try to convince, or just try to live my life in the light? What's your advice when you have people who are close to you, really close to you, that you love, who just don't believe?
Yes. How do we relate, especially to people we love who don't share the same religious conviction or experience that we do, or even mystical experience?
Well, this is beyond religion as far as
yeah,
I'm concerned.
Yes, okay. How do we just relate to them as human beings? Well, what do we say, what do we don't say? Well, perhaps the first thing we need to realize is maybe the individual doesn't believe in God as defined as we do. You know, down through the ages, there have been different ideas of who, what, where is God. And we have said that in many of the writings in the Western mystical tradition, God is sometimes portrayed as a being. We even heard the rabbis in one sense use the pronoun he, and in other times speak of it as an infinite principle. So perhaps there might not be the same belief in our particular understanding of what God is. But aside from that, remember that by necessity, the truest, most real mystical experiences cannot be expressed completely in words. They are truly symbolic. The reality is purely with the individual who, in speaking with others and sharing their ideas, we find that some people who have had similar experiences understand it in the same way, and we develop a vocabulary, a way of expressing it with them. But others don't have that experience. Remember that... In the Kabbalistic tradition, the idea is that the human being can become a broken vessel. Well, what happens with a broken vessel? They can no longer contain the water of life. It leaks out. Or a light bulb, if shattered, cannot give forth the light generated by electricity, which is all around us as a reality. And so forth. In a particular individual at a certain time in their life, they might not have that inner conviction that there is something in them, that they are touching them that is real, eternal, permanent, above the physical, and yet very much real to them. They may, and we give it a name. We call it God, or we call it the God within, or the ultimate root and source of life. Whatever word we put to it, it is a reality. And the best way we can worship and express it is not so much in trying to convince others, but make it a manifestation in our lives, to make it a power in our lives through good works, through deeds, to bring it forth in the service of others. That's the best way to communicate the reality and manifest that principle. Yes?
We think an important question we could ask ourselves is, what did I think and feel 20 years ago, 30 years ago? There's a possibility for anyone else to arrive at that conclusion.
Yes. So what does the rabbi say, that is the rabbi Ari says, that all souls are one with this universal oversoul of this deity, and they have all moved away and have separated from, and in time they will all come back, but not necessarily at the same time. They each have their own individual self-conscious path of return. And so we are in one particular phase, they are in another. That does not mean that they are any less good human beings. They may be more generous than us through their own inspiration, but they may not have yet consciously awakened to that inner reality. And that's where the path of the mystic begins, when there is a rebirth or a reawakening in their consciousness of the reality of that inner world and the impression and the effect that has on their outer life. We think there was a hand over here. Yes.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that they were not awakened to their inner life, that the soul is not awakened yet. And in this philosophy of mysticism, regardless of which mysticism we're talking about, that is an inner perceptive power that has to be awakened through that individual. And it cannot be put in from the outside. We can help them, but we cannot make them awaken. And Mr. Judge has an article on it saying that it awakens at its appropriate time, as you mentioned.
Yes. Now, we have not gone into it because there's just not the time, but in the Kabbalah, of the various traditions and rabbis and branches, there are all sorts of prayers and meditations and practices that are helpful to individuals. As a matter of fact, one of the popular ways in which the Kabbalah has expressed itself in the 20th and the 21st century is in a way which is stripped of any reference to the Torah or Judaism per se, but it's just a presentation of the practical meditative practices. And some of our famous celebrities have spoken of their identification with and practice of Kabbalah. Well, that's what they're referring to, because there is very practical advice in how to awaken that realization and full self-awareness without any reference to any religious devotion. And on the other hand, there are schools and branches we have right here in Philadelphia, the so-called Chabad, Lubavitch, which are pretty much devoted to the understanding of getting knowledge and wisdom and understanding of this divine through study and through meditation and through devotion. So we see the whole spectrum coming forth in this dimension. We think as we go through the afternoon, you'll see that more and more in our modern times, these ancient traditions, which are at one time differentiated, in our modern times with cross-communication and exchange of ideas and freedom of thought, we've learned to identify the universal aspects so that a Sufi can now speak to a mystic Christian or a student of the Kabbalah, and they have a common feeling and language by which they can identify and communicate with one another. That may not have existed hundreds of years ago. Yes, in the back.
Yeah, I was just wondering,
there was an earlier comment about how confusing the study of Kabbalah, if one approaches it. Would it be appropriate to make some comments on how one is taught or introduction to the practical understanding of Kabbalah? Would that
sure.
be
yeah,
appropriate?
Sure.
Usually, one reaches an age of 49, according to certain law. There's a tacit inner asking and acceptance by the Kabbalistic teacher, which is consistent to certain general principles. And there's a recognition of a binding to see something through, akin to a pledge. And it usually begins with an introduction of two principles to consider, nefesh and ruach. My pronunciation can be completely wrong.
Nefesh and ruach.
Yes, thank you. And then the introduction begins with the re-examination of the rituals and festivals that are ingrained in the Jewish tradition. And if I could take one as an example, Sukkot, I'm not pronouncing it correctly.
Sukkot, yeah.
Those that have a Jewish tradition, what is associated with that holiday, Sukkot? So I can begin to give an example of a practical application of how the Kabbalah would be taught practically, because the intellectual approach, if just focused, is a misdirection of blind that leads away to ultimately that devotional and the awakening of the inner aspects, as the previous student said, that would give a direct inner response to that which is first given in theory. And essentially, Sukkot, you know, we set up the four walls of a temporary building, and the roof has to be open so the sight of the star is not lost. When one is taught the mathematical proportions which that Sukkot should conform to, one begins to have, with the teachings of the Kabbalist teacher, an understanding of what was implied about what is the temporary of the instrument man and what is permanent. And in fact, that keeping the roof open and never losing sight of that guiding star which will get you through the wilderness has to do with that permanent aspect, and then there's further teachings. So taking the very familiar symbolic expressions of the festivals, the deeper understanding of what is contained in Kabbalah begins. And from that approach, there is no confusion, because symbolic references or begin to be shown the deeper meaning, and hence why the preservation of the rituals through the traditions.
Thank you for that. We'll take one more contribution, and then we'll take a short break. Go ahead.
We don't understand the language, but I see what you mean. Now, how can we see when we are listening? I listened to everything that was said, and I see what you mean. How are we approaching?
Well, it's interesting. We talked, the contribution was made a while ago about developing the inner senses, or clear seeing, or psychic clairvoyance, ability to see with these inner senses. When you think about it, we could not understand one another unless we could see directly the reality of the ideas they're talking about. Language itself is a symbolic. We have to make certain connections in the brain in order to perceive and use language. But once we have that language, we can sense what a person is saying with those words and what they're not saying, what they mean and what they don't mean. We can read the same book over and over again, and each time we read the same words, the same sentences, what we draw out of that book, the meaning, is different because we see into it differently. We see what the author means, and that power to see and that depth of meaning grows with every cycle because we are growing. And so that's the whole idea of the Kabbalah and the Torah. And the individual as well. There's more to the Torah, there's more to ourselves, there's more to life than we can see with our eyes. So we have to develop the inner means to do that. So we're going to take a short break now for about 10 minutes or so, give you a chance if you want to get a cup of coffee or talk, and then we'll come back and continue with the historical roots of Christian mysticism, which it promises to be very illuminating to you.